KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Good morning. Hamas has named more than 30 Israeli hostages in Gaza, including two dual U.S. citizens it says it would release in a ceasefire with Israel. Is the deal getting any closer? It's Morning Edition from NPR News. The Biden administration has cut the number of Guantanamo detainees nearly in half after transferring 11 of them to Oman. I'm Amy Martinez.
And I'm Michelle Martin. We'll look at the president's push to close the detention facility before leaving office. Plus, Elon Musk takes on British Prime Minister Keir Starmer. And do you have a favorite snow tradition? We share some of ours. It is Tuesday, January 7th. South Dakota Senator John Thune has a lot to celebrate right now. The Republican just became Senate Majority Leader a few days ago, and today he turns 64 years old. And the news is next.
Live from NPR News, I'm Korva Coleman. President Biden is using his executive authority to create two new national monuments in California. NPR's Deepa Shivaram reports.
The two national monuments are Chuckwalla and Satitla Highlands. Their designation means the land will be protected from development and preserved for its significance to tribal nations and ecological importance. For example, the Satitla Highlands Monument includes a dormant volcano and is home to the longest known lava tube system in the world. The White House says with these two monuments, Biden is setting a record for the most land and water conserved by any president. It will also establish the longest stretch of protected land in the continental United States, about 18 million acres of land stretching through California, Arizona, Nevada, and Utah. Deepa Shivaram, NPR News.
The Minneapolis City Council has voted to enter into a federal consent decree with the U.S. Justice Department. The federal agency investigated after then-Minneapolis police officers murdered George Floyd in 2020. Officials found a pattern of racial discrimination. Minnesota Public Radio's Estelle Timar Wilcox says officials hope a judge will quickly approve the decree for the Minneapolis Police Department.
The department will have to draft a new use of force policy. It bans chokeholds and neck restraints and limits the use of pepper spray. One of the big concerns centered around investigations into a complaint against an officer. Those will now continue even if an officer quits or retires.
Estelle Timar Wilcox reporting. Forecasters have posted dangerous wind warnings for the Los Angeles area. The National Weather Service says these winds could gust to hurricane strength today and knock over huge trees or even tractor trailers. Meanwhile, forecasters have posted cautions for exceptionally cold weather in the south this morning. Some Gulf Coast areas from Texas to Florida could see temperatures near 20 degrees. The weather cautions come as parts of the central U.S. and the Mid-Atlantic recover from a major winter storm. States from Missouri to New Jersey got heavy snow and ice. Stocks opened mixed this morning as the Commerce Department reported a widening of the U.S. trade deficit in November. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the Dow Jones Industrials rose about 40 points in early trading.
The nation's trade gap grew more than 6% in November, topping $78 billion. Exports were up during the month, but imports rose even faster. Both exports and imports often depend on longshoremen. Dock workers from East Coast and Gulf Coast ports are back at the bargaining table today with shipping companies, hoping to reach a contract before a January 15th deadline. The dock workers suspended their strike after a three-day walkout this fall. The two sides have agreed to a 62% pay raise over the next 6 years, but still have to come to terms over shipyard automation. Asian stocks were mixed overnight, up in Shanghai and Tokyo, but down in Hong Kong. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
This is NPR. Chinese state media have increased the death toll from today's earthquake in Tibet. At least 126 people have been killed. The U.S. Geological Survey says the quake's magnitude was 7.1. Reports say people are still trapped in rubble. 1,000 homes were damaged. The number of transgender teenagers in the U.S. is extremely small. That's according to a study published yesterday in the journal JAMA Pediatrics. NPR's Selena Simmons-Duffin reports that small group has been the subject of intense focus from Republican lawmakers in the last few years.
The study was conducted by researchers at Harvard and Folks Health, a virtual LGBTQ healthcare company. They used a data set of private insurance claims that included more than 5 million adolescents and found that less than 0.1% of them are transgender and receive gender-related medicines. Here's lead author Landon Hughes of Harvard.
It's a very, very small number of people and has managed to eat up all of the oxygen in our political discourse over the last few months in many ways.
The incoming Trump administration has pledged to enact a number of policies that would affect this small group, including a federal ban on gender-affirming care for youth. Selena Simmons-Duffin, NPR News.
The body of former President Jimmy Carter will be moved today from the Carter Center in Atlanta to Washington, D.C. He will lie in state in the U.S. Capitol Rotunda until early Thursday morning. Mourners will then hold his state funeral. Carter died last week at the age of 100. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Charles Stewart Mott Foundation. For nearly a century, supporting efforts to promote a just, equitable, and sustainable society. More at Mott.org. And the listeners who support this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm A. Martinez in Los Angeles, California.
And I'm Michelle Martin in Washington, D.C. Good morning. Coming up, we will tell you about the obscure federal government committee at the center of President Biden's decision to block the merger between U.S. Steel and Nippon Steel.
First, though, Hamas has named 34 Israeli hostages in Gaza, including two dual U.S. citizens. It says it is willing to release in a ceasefire deal under negotiation with Israel. It's the most serious sign of progress toward a pause in the 15-month war between Israel and Hamas. NPR's Daniel Estrin is now on the line from the field in Jerusalem. Daniel, so we've heard about so many ceasefire efforts over so many months, and none of them has been successful. Anything different now about this one?
There is a little bit that's different. Hamas is projecting optimism. A Hamas leader on Monday said that most of the issues are resolved. And Israeli officials are mostly quiet, which actually suggests that there is some movement behind the scenes. I think the major factor now is that President Trump is entering the White House in just under 2 weeks. Trump on Monday repeated his ultimatum that if hostages are not freed by his inauguration January 20th, quote, there will be hell to pay. So there are talks continuing in Qatar now. The framework of the deal has been known for a long time. It would be exchanging Palestinian prisoners held by Israel for Israeli hostages captured by Hamas in the October 7th attacks. What is new here is that for the first time, Hamas has named 34 hostages that it's willing to release.
Okay, and 34, though, that's not all the hostages in Gaza. I mean, what about the others?
Yeah, it's just about a third of the approximately 100 hostages still being held in Gaza, some of them alive, some of them dead. The young male soldiers would continue to be held in Gaza if this interim deal goes through. The reason this would be just a partial deal is that Hamas will not give up all of the hostages until Israel is ready to permanently end the war. And families of Israeli hostages are upset at this negotiation, this deal coming through now, because their priority is the release of all of the hostages. There is one mother of hostage who gave a press conference, Meirav Leshem Gonen, and she addressed President Trump directly. Let's listen.
You are the most powerful and strongest leader in the world. Please don't let any hostage stay behind. Please make sure all hostages are coming back home.
And it's notable, you hear many Israeli hostage families turning not to their own Israeli leadership, but to President-elect Trump.
Now, who would be released if this deal indeed comes through?
Well, it's a group of hostages that Israel considers humanitarian cases. Female soldiers, civilian women, two infants, and 22 men of various ages who either have chronic illnesses or who are fathers. And that group includes dual U.S.-Israeli nationals Sagi Dekel Chen and Keith Siegel. There still are a lot of details to negotiate. This is definitely not a done deal. Israel wants to know exactly who among this list is alive. And if Hamas exchanges that information with Israel, that could provide a breakthrough. But that is still one major stumbling block to resolve.
That's NPR's Daniel Estrin reporting from Jerusalem. Thank you.
You're welcome.
U.S. Steel and Nippon Steel are preparing to battle the U.S. government in court after President Biden blocked their proposed merger. Biden justified his action by arguing it poses a risk to national security because Nippon Steel is based overseas. The decision to block the nearly $15 billion merger was supposed to be guided by a little-known government group, the Committee on Foreign Investment in the United States, known by its acronym CFIUS. But the committee, which includes representatives from multiple U.S. agencies, was actually split on whether the deal should be approved or denied. So that made us curious about this committee. So we've called Sarah Bowerly Dansman for this. She is a former State Department policy advisor and case analyst for the committee. And I do want to mention she was not involved in these discussions. Good morning.
Good morning, Michelle.
So tell me about this Committee on Foreign Investment in the United States. How is it created? What problem is it intended to solve?
Yes, so CFIUS was created in 1975, and over the years it has developed into a much stronger interagency committee that reviews national security concerns of foreign investment into the U.S. when a foreign company seeks to buy a U.S. business. And the purpose of CFIUS is to ensure that any decision to block a transaction for national security reasons is done so only because of a fact-based assessment of the risk rather than for political reasons.
How unusual is it that the committee was split on its decision?
Well, it's not unprecedented, but it is unusual. The committee really seeks to develop consensus among it and doesn't like to bring a split decision to the president. It wants to speak with a unified voice if possible.
So if the committee is supposed to advise the president, I do have to ask if the president, if President Biden overstepped by publicly stating his preference that the deal be blocked before the committee made its recommendation.
Well, I'm sure that Nippon Steel and U.S. Steel are going to point to that in their proceedings. But of course, I was not involved in the inner workings of this particular deal. And so I don't want to comment too strongly on that.
I wonder, though, if there is a precedent for a president having publicly expressed a preference. I mean, I am thinking about there are other independent bodies like the Fed, for example, that make their own decisions apart from what a president may or may not, whatever a president's preferences may be. And presidents do occasionally. I mean, obviously, President Trump comes to mind, former President Trump comes to mind, and future President Trump comes to mind, who often stated his views about what the Fed should do. And the Fed, obviously, as an independent body, would make its own decisions. But as an advisory body, I'm just trying to figure out if there's a precedent for this.
Yes, so CFIUS likes to, you mentioned at the top that it's kind of a shadowy organization. And
well, I didn't use the word shadowy. I mean, okay. I would imagine that most Americans have never heard of. I certainly had not.
Yes, it's frequently discussed as a shadowy or very kind of secretive organization, and it is that way because when CFIUS is doing reviews, it is trying to, you know, it has to get a lot of information from the parties involved. And so it doesn't want to be on front page news. It doesn't want to move markets as everyone is waiting on its decision. And so typically the idea is to keep what's happening on CFIUS out of the news until the decision has been made. But in the end, it really is the president's decision about whether to block a transaction or not. CFIUS can only advise the president on this, but it's his decision to make. And so in that respect, it's a little bit different from the Fed and other more independent bodies.
Point taken. So thanks for that clarification. Before we let you go, do you have a thought about what this might mean for foreign investment in the U.S. going forward?
Well, I think that going forward, other countries and other companies that are foreign are really going to question whether they will be able to invest in the U.S. and create jobs in the U.S. and strengthen those kinds of ties in the U.S.
That's Sarah Bowerly-Denton. She's a former case analyst for CFIUS. That's the Committee on Foreign Investment in the United States. She's now a professor at Indiana University and a senior fellow at the Atlantic Council. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
A strike by ski patrollers at the nation's largest ski resort has hobbled operations and disappointed customers for 12 straight days. As NPR's Kirk Sigler reports, patrollers in Park City, Utah are asking for a $2 an hour raise.
Ski patrollers do everything from mountain rescues to setting off avalanche control explosives. And the Park City Mountain Resort, owned by Colorado conglomerate Vail Resorts, has more than 200 patrol and safety staff. And this strike that began December 27th is happening at one of the busiest and most important times economically for the ski industry.
Pay your employees! Pay your employees!
Social media is awash with videos like this showing frustrated Park City customers standing in long lift lines. There weren't enough patrollers to open the best terrain when a big snowstorm blanketed the Wasatch Mountains this past weekend. Other Instagram posts show guests ducking ropes into closed zones, and ski news sites report some people injured waiting for long stretches or just evacuating themselves off ski runs.
This could have been very easily avoided.
Margot Klingensmith, the patroller for 6 years, is the business manager for the Park City Professional Ski Patrol Association. She says the union has been trying to negotiate with Vail for months.
It's been a little shocking that the company continues to be comfortable running the mountain with such little terrain open, with such a small fraction of the ski patrol and mountain safety that would normally be working there.
Vail, which bought Park City in 2014, says the resort has been open and operating safely. They've been sending patrol managers and staff from other states to fill in during the strike. The company declined an interview request, but in a statement it said Park City patrollers have gotten a 50% wage increase over the past four seasons, quote, far outpacing inflation.
For the union makes us strong.
But the tensions that culminated in this strike go back a long time. The union nearly walked off the job 3 years ago when most patrollers were making between $13 to $18 an hour. They now make on average $25 an hour. But Margot Klingensmith of the union says that's still not enough to live in one of the most expensive places in the West.
We're seeing folks' wages just not keep up with housing costs and grocery costs and like the basics that people need to pay for to be able to afford to live even remotely in the area of where their job is.
The union and company say they've made some progress with a federal mediator in recent days, but the strike continues. Kirk Sigler, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
On the next Fresh Air, actor Adrian Brody joins us to talk about his role in the 3.5-hour film The Brutalist. Brody says he drew from his mother and grandfather's experiences of immigrating from Hungary to the U.S. to portray a Hungarian Jewish architect and Holocaust survivor who seeks a fresh start in post-World War II America. Join us.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Cunard, sailing the transatlantic crossing between New York and Southampton, England on Queen Mary II, dedicated to providing White Star service, fine dining, and enrichment programs. Learn more at Cunard.com. From Imaginable Futures, celebrating the hard work, commitment, and achievements of the 1 in 5 college students who are parents. More at ImaginableFutures.com. From the Kauffman Foundation, providing access to opportunities that help people achieve financial stability, upward mobility, and economic prosperity, regardless of race, gender, or geography. Kauffman.org. And from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm A. Martinez.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Pope Francis has selected a vocal critic of President-elect Donald Trump as the new Archbishop of Washington, D.C. It is one of the most high-profile Catholic leadership positions in the U.S., and he has selected San Diego Cardinal Robert McElroy. NPR religion correspondent Jason DeRose is with us now to tell us more about this. Good morning, Jason.
Good morning.
Let's start with the incoming Archbishop's criticisms of Donald Trump. What has he said?
Well, a few specific areas have been a focus for McElroy. He called the Muslim ban during the first Trump administration religious prejudice. This was, of course, the ban on people from predominantly Muslim countries entering the U.S. McElroy also worked against family separations at the border, which took place during the first Trump administration. And he's been especially vocal about Trump's threats of mass deportations. He's called them gravely evil. McElroy says it's unthinkable to rip people out of their homes and their lives and their Catholic congregations. And Michelle, he says Catholics should oppose deportations with the same energy they give to abortion.
Why is McElroy taking up immigration as an issue?
Well, some of it has to do with the fact that he's been the Archbishop of San Diego for nearly a decade, right there at the U.S.-Mexico border. Some of his flock are immigrants and some are refugees. He saw what family separations did to people there. And it's also a deeply theological and deeply biblical issue for Cardinal McElroy. Here he is speaking at a University of California event, saying it should matter to all Catholics because God, as Jesus, came to humans as a refugee.
Our scriptures tell us that Jesus, Mary, and Joseph had to flee out of Israel into Egypt because of oppression. They were refugees.
Jason, remind us what he's referencing there.
Well, he's talking about a story in the New Testament from the Gospel of Matthew, which many people may have actually heard read in church during Christmas recently. In that story, King Herod wants to kill the baby Jesus, and so the family flees to Egypt to escape. McElroy says that this story helps draw attention to the plight of all people fleeing oppression, and that it signals that refugees and immigrants should be met with compassion.
What's been the reaction so far to Pope Francis naming Cardinal McElroy as the D.C. Archbishop?
Well, it's hard to divorce this announcement from the fact that Trump is about to take office. And remember that incoming Vice President J.D. Vance is Catholic. McElroy is a strong surrogate for Pope Francis and his agenda. I spoke with the executive director of the Catholic group Call to Action named Black Moses Rankins. He's one of many progressive Catholics thrilled by this announcement.
We've been using church to say why these people should be scapegoated, why these people should be pushed to the side. The appointment of McElroy says, wait, hold up. Actually, those people do belong a part of God. You're all supposed to care for them.
And what about politically conservative Catholics?
Well, they've been critical of McElroy for his stance on immigration and on other issues within the church, including his work toward inclusion of LGBTQ Catholics in the life of the church. But the appointment, I think, Michelle, reiterates Pope Francis's position that immigration politics are something Catholics need to take seriously and that he's willing to go toe-to-toe with the Trump administration.
That's NPR religion correspondent Jason DeRose. Jason, thank you.
You're welcome.
So, Michelle Martin, I am here in gloriously sunny Los Angeles watching all that snow fall on much of the central and eastern U.S. So what's it been like over there?
It has been cold. A shout out to all the people who have to be out in it, especially the people who are out clearing the sidewalks. Thanks for asking.
Cold, wet, wintry.
It's pretty.
Right?
Yeah, it's pretty. Yeah.
So, okay, so here's a question I have to ask East Coasters. What are some of the favorite snow day activities?
Well, I mean, cooking, of course. But cooking.
Warm stuff.
That's right. But Morning Edition's own Ashley Westerman has a family tradition making snow cream. Here she is with the recipe.
1 cup milk, 1/2 cup sugar, 1 teaspoon of vanilla, and you stir that until the sugar dissolves. And after that, you add fresh snow in big spoonfuls.
Sounds delicious.
Well, I haven't tried it, but Westerman says she's been eating snow cream since she was a little kid growing up in rural Western Kentucky.
And it is truly one of my most favorite things when it snows, and it always, always reminds me of home and my family.
All right, so that covers some food. What about some favorite snow day activities?
Okay, so here are some of our other Morning Edition colleagues.
Since becoming a homeowner, my tradition has been to shovel the front walkway and then shovel the front walkways of some of my elderly neighbors and then complain about back pain for about 3 months.
One of my favorite things to do when it snows is to break out the skis and ski in places where you normally wouldn't be able to, like down a driveway or in a hill in my neighborhood.
So being from California, I never got to experience the joy of a snow day. But now, whenever I see it snowing outside, I always just have this immediate urge to go sledding with a bunch of people. I just think it's the perfect way to spend a snow day, and I hope to do it soon this week as the snow continues to fall.
My kids are 5 and 3, so when they see the snow, forget breakfast, snowsuits right on top of pajamas and off to this, the top of our favorite hill. Clara, Callum, you guys ready to go? Here we go on the sled. 3, 2, 1.
Why aren't we out there with them, A?
You can. I'm glad I'm not.
Okay. That's producers Phil Harrell, Claire Marishima, Mansi Karana, and Adam Byrne sharing their snow day traditions.
Now, you know, you heard Adam Byrne there. Early last year, around, I think it was like January, February, that was the first time, and I was in Reno with Adam Byrne. We were on a reporting trip. That was the first time I'd been somewhere, Michelle, where snow was falling. I'd never had snow fall on my face before.
You don't know what you're missing.
Oh, I know what
you
I'm missing.
You do not know what you're missing.
I'm glad I'm missing it.
We could persuade you.
Tomorrow on Morning Edition, we'll take you from this planet to another one. NASA is expected to provide an update on its troubled effort to return pristine rocks from the surface of Mars. Listen live on the NPR app or your local station. This is NPR News.
Rocky Mountain spotted fever is the deadliest tick-borne disease in the U.S. In the Southwest, tribal communities have made progress in preventing deaths from the disease.
The difference I've seen in the past 12, 13 years I've been here, like this time of year, you'd see dogs packed with ticks in their ears.
I'm Mary Louise Kelly, How They Did It, on All Things Considered from NPR News.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. Special Counsel Jack Smith says the Justice Department could release some of his findings about President-elect Donald Trump before the end of the week. Smith investigated Trump's handling of classified documents at his Mar-a-Lago estate, as well as Trump's efforts to overturn the results of the 2020 election. Both cases were shelved after Trump won the November presidential election. Trump's attorneys are seeking to block the release of Smith's final report. The top bank regulator at the Federal Reserve is stepping down from that position, though he plans to remain on the Fed's governing board. Here's NPR's Scott Horsley.
Fed Governor Michael Barr plans to resign from his post as vice chair of bank supervision by the end of next month, hoping to avoid a possible showdown with incoming President Donald Trump. But Barr plans to remain on the Fed's governing board, which means Trump may have to select a replacement from the central bank's existing panel of board members. Barr says in a statement that a dispute over the post with the incoming president could be a distraction from the Fed's mission. Trump's authority to fire the vice chair, or even the Fed chairman, has not been tested in court. Barr was picked for the post by President Biden and led the Fed's effort to tighten bank supervision. Any successor chosen by Trump is likely to approach regulation with a lighter touch. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
This is NPR News from Washington. Hundreds of airline flight delays and cancellations are being reported today at airports along the East Coast, a day after a winter storm dumped snow and ice over a wide area. Airports in Washington, Baltimore, New York, Boston, and Atlanta are among those reporting issues, according to the tracking service FlightAware. A new study involving mice looks at how chance and competition can shape an individual's life trajectory. NPR's Jonathan Lambert reports.
When scientists consider why some animals do better than others, they often point to genes or the environment. But sometimes critters just get lucky. To study the role of luck, researchers raised groups of genetically identical mice in outdoor enclosures, allowing them to assess the impact of chance experiences, like happening to get to food first. When competition for resources was high, some individuals ended up doing significantly better than others over the course of their lives, the researchers report in the journal Science. That divergence largely didn't happen when competition was low, suggesting that competition can magnify the importance of luck. Jonathan Lambert, NPR News.
The death toll is rising in Tibet following this morning's strong earthquake. Officials say more than 120 people are known dead. Many others have been injured or trapped in the rubble. The number of damaged homes tops 1,000. I'm Dave Mattingly in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Arm with the new podcast series Tech Unheard. Arm CEO Renee Haas talks to tech company leaders like Mike Gallagher from Titletown Tech, who are working to help shape the future of computing. Available on all podcast platforms. And from Procter & Gamble, maker of Metamucil, a fiber supplement containing psyllium, a plant-based fiber for trapping and removing waste in the digestive system, designed to be taken every day. More at Metamucil.com. This is NPR.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm A. Martinez in Los Angeles, California.
And I'm Michelle Martin in Washington, D.C. The number of people being held at the U.S. military court in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, has been cut nearly in half.
That's after the Biden administration transferred 11 detainees to Oman yesterday. It's part of Joe Biden's final push to try and close the detention facility before leaving office.
NPR's Sasha Pfeiffer has been covering Guantanamo for years, and she's with us now to tell us more about it. Good morning, Sasha.
Good morning, Michelle.
Who are these 11 people?
All are from Yemen. All were captured after the 9/11 attacks, and all are former al-Qaeda, according to the Pentagon. All had also been held for more than two decades without charge or trial. Now, eventually they were approved for transfer after national security officials said they weren't dangerous enough to keep holding. And they had been approved for transfer for at least 2 years, sometimes much longer, once since 2010. But they had stayed behind bars due to diplomatic and political challenges, like resistance to releasing them, and the really difficult, slow process of finding countries to take them. The problem is they could not go back to their home country of Yemen because it's unstable, so the U.S. had to negotiate with another country to take them. Finally, Oman agreed to do that. Some of them will be monitored for security reasons and also face travel restrictions. And for Guantanamo, the end result is just 15 prisoners are held there now.
Well, you know, so Democrats have been trying to close this facility for years, and the Biden administration had 4 years to do this. Tell us about this last-minute flurry of transfers weeks before leaving office. How did this all come together?
And it really has been a flurry. You know, in recent weeks, four other Guantanamo prisoners were released. We know of at least one more transfer in the works. This is partly Biden racing to fulfill his goal of closing Guantanamo. A less charitable view is that it would have taken more political courage to do this when he was not a lame duck. But now that he's on his way out, it's easier to do hard and controversial things. I do want to note that yesterday's 11-prisoner transfer almost happened in October 2023. But it was called off after the October 7th Hamas attack. So finally, in these final weeks, that plan got resurrected. It's also motivated by Trump returning. Trump has said he wants to keep Guantanamo open. So the assumption is that once Trump is back in the White House, there may be no more Guantanamo transfers under him. And Michelle, at some level, it's also Biden acknowledging that Guantanamo has been a failed legal system. As you know, there's still been no 9/11 trial, more than two decades after the September 11, 2001 attacks. There's worldwide criticism of Guantanamo as a human rights embarrassment because of the unlawful detention happening there. It's also really expensive, $15 million per year per prisoner. That is way more than a federal supermax. It's just Biden saying it's time to shut the place down.
So what's been the reaction to this?
Republicans claim this is like releasing terrorists. Democrats say this should have happened a long time ago. It's a moral stain on America, they say. This is complicated by the new fresh upheaval in the Middle East because there's some concern these men could end up back on a battlefield somewhere. But remember, national security officials has made the decision these men no longer pose a significant threat. I got a more hybrid or nuanced view from Scott Rehm of the Center for Victims of Torture. He's glad the men were released, but he says it could and should have happened sooner. And he says because it didn't happen sooner, time is now running out on transferring others before Trump comes into office.
Releasing this many men in just a few weeks makes clear what could have been done over the rest of the last 4 years had the administration acted then with the same urgency and commitment that it's acting now.
Sasha, before we let you go, could you remind us of the history of the Guantanamo prison over the years?
The prison and the military court were set up to prosecute suspected foreign terrorists after the September 11th attacks. Over the years, a little under 800 people have passed through there. Most were never charged, yet held for years. There are now 15 left, and the commonality among the 15 left is that if you're not out by January 20th, you're expected probably not to get out.
That is NPR's Sasha Pfeiffer. Sasha, thank you.
You're welcome.
Elon Musk's posts on X are suddenly filled with vitriol for the British government. He's called it tyrannical and says the prime minister is a national embarrassment. Britons are wondering why, as NPR's Lauren Frayer reports from London.
All right, well, good evening, everybody. Welcome.
A little over a year ago, Elon Musk was at London's Lancaster House, where part of the TV show The Crown was filmed. He was there for a fireside chat with the then Prime Minister Rishi Sunak, a conservative. They were both kind of fawning.
Elon, thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
We feel very privileged. We're excited to have you.
But Sunak was unpopular and got voted out last summer, replaced with a new centre-left Prime Minister Keir Starmer, whom Musk has made clear he does not like. For example, when Starmer's government jailed people for online hate speech that fueled race riots last summer, Musk, who spread some of the disinformation himself from afar, accused Starmer of running a police state and trampling on free speech. Musk's latest fixation, though, is a child sex abuse scandal that happened here more than a decade ago.
Nine Asian men who were convicted of sexually exploiting vulnerable girls have been given prison sentences of up to 19 years.
Mostly British Pakistani men were convicted of grooming mostly white British girls. And the far right seized on this, accusing politicians of failing to crack down out of fear of appearing racist. Starmer was a top prosecutor back then.
There's a lot to be sorry about and to be shameful about the way Britain as a society was too late to deal with the grooming gangs. But Starmer was part of making the change that got prosecutions.
Sundar Katwala directs British Future, a nonpartisan think tank. He says justice may have been slow in that scandal, but there was no cover-up, certainly not involving Starmer, who actually sped up those prosecutions. Musk is nevertheless calling for the UK Prime Minister to be imprisoned. He also endorsed a post calling on King Charles to dissolve Parliament and remove Starmer from power, something the monarch is not allowed to do. This is unprecedented from the incoming head of a White House advisory panel about a top U.S. ally, Katwala says. He doubts President-elect Trump approved it and says it does not reflect official U.S. policy.
I think this is very much Elon Musk freelancing. If he was thinking about his role as a member of the incoming US administration, he would be playing by the diplomatic rules. And it's very clear that Elon Musk thinks that none of those rules apply to him.
UK officials' strategy had been to ignore Musk's trolling. But after he called another British cabinet minister, Jess Phillips, an evil witch and a, quote, rape genocide apologist, she got death threats, and Starmer himself spoke out.
When the poison of the far right leads to serious threats to Jess Phillips and others, in my book, a line has been crossed.
That was at a press conference where Starmer wanted to talk about much-needed reforms to the UK health service, but was instead inundated with questions about this grooming scandal, which was prosecuted and investigated years ago. Starmer condemned lies and misinformation that he says are undermining democracy. Lauren Freyer, NPR News, London.
This is NPR News.
Oscar-nominated documentary Porcelain War tells Ukrainians on the front line and the fragilest porcelain culture they fight to protect. Next time, here and now.
The latest in national politics, inspiring podcasts, and a report from your local school board meeting last week. You can hear it all in one place with the NPR app. Download it today. Good morning, I'm Michelle Martin. DC's first snowstorm of the year turned into a winter wonderland for the National Zoo's newest panda pair. Bao Li and Qing Bao, both 3 years old, romped and rolled around in the 5 or so inches of snow that blanketed their enclosure. They are native to China's mountains, so they've seen snow before, and their thick fur is suited to it. The zoo shared video of the pandas' adventures in the snow ahead of their official debut later this month. It's Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Uma, a cloud-based phone service for any size business, with an automated virtual receptionist, video meetings, and other features to connect to customers and coworkers anywhere at uma.com/NPR. And from Workday, with AI at the core of its system, Workday is committed to delivering continuous innovation to prepare organizations for what's next. Workday, an enterprise platform for finance and HR rock stars. This is NPR.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Amy Martinez.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Good morning. The Minneapolis City Council has voted unanimously to enter an agreement with the U.S. Department of Justice to reform the city's police department.
The consent decree is intended to address decades of discriminatory policing. Nearly 5 years ago, George Floyd was murdered by a Minneapolis police officer, which sparked protests around the country and around the world.
Minnesota Public Radio's Estelle Timar Wilcox is with us now to talk about the agreement and what it proposes to do. Good morning, Estelle.
Good morning, Michelle.
So the Justice Department began its scrutiny of the Minneapolis Police Department just after George Floyd was killed. What did they find that led to this consent decree?
Well, they found a pattern of racial discrimination and excessive use of force, particularly against Black and Native American people. They also noted inappropriate responses when people were experiencing a behavioral health crisis. City officials have been in talks with the Department of Justice since then to try to reach this consent agreement. And the state at the same time reached a separate settlement with the city about a year ago, also mandating several reforms, which the department is now working towards.
Yeah, the mayor, Jacob Frey, said the agreement set a clear path forward for police in the community. What's in it?
Well, the department will have to draft a new use of force policy. It bans chokeholds and neck restraints and limits the use of pepper spray. One of the big concerns centered around investigations into a complaint against an officer. Those will now continue even if an officer quits or retires. Assistant Attorney General Kristen Clark called the settlement a critical step for constitutional policing.
George Floyd's death was not just a tragedy, it was a galvanizing force for the city and for the nation. All eyes remain on Minneapolis. And with this consent decree, we now have a roadmap for reform that will help this community heal while strengthening trust between law enforcement and the people they serve.
You know, I want to mention here that this agreement is the 16th policing settlement that the Justice Department is currently enforcing. That's according to the Assistant Attorney General, Kristen Clark. Do these agreements work?
Well, Clark says they do, and she noted success stories in other cities that have consent decrees, like Seattle, which she said drastically reduced the use of force, and New Orleans, which reached its lowest rate of critical incidents in 2023. And here in Minneapolis, lots of police accountability activists were actually pushing for a consent decree. Michelle Gross was one of them.
We have to have this agreement. Even if it isn't ideal, even if it isn't perfect, we need this agreement to go forward.
Even so, activists say it's not an end-all solution to police brutality.
And the city council, as you were noting, voted unanimously to enact this consent decree. And what happens now?
Well, once a federal judge signs it, it'll go into effect, and advocates are hoping that will happen before Donald Trump's inauguration, because Trump's last administration opposed using consent decrees. Once it's enacted, a federal judge and an independent monitor will oversee progress on it, and it'll stay in effect until the federal courts decide that all the conditions have been met, which could be years from now.
That is Minnesota Public Radio's Estelle Timar Wilcox. Estelle, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
Later today on All Things Considered, the most precious commodity in Gaza might not be food or medical supplies, but cash. Cash is disintegrating from overuse, and new banknotes aren't being sent to Gaza during the war. That's led to e-banking and cash repair services. Listen live on the NPR app or your local station. This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Amy Martinez.
And I'm Michelle Martin.
Facebook and Instagram will let users decide about dodgy online content.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Figure, offering a streamlined online application for a home equity line of credit. Homeowners receive a no-obligation HELOC rate in minutes with funding in as few as 5 days at figure.com. And by Viking, exploring the world in comfort. With a fleet of small ships, Viking offers travel experiences for the thinking person. Discover more at viking.com.
I'm David Brancaccio in New York. Meta, Facebook, Instagram, is going to let users decide if posts are dangerous and can affix notes and ratings to that effect. These community-based moderators will not be able to take down misinformation. Meta is also adding a prominent supporter of the incoming president to its board of directors. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer has more.
Meta CEO Mark Zuckerberg says the company will end its fact-checking program, which was run by an independent third party. Instead, it'll use a community notes program. Zuckerberg says Meta will also change its content moderation policies. He says Facebook and Instagram have been limiting what he calls legitimate political debate and, quote, censoring too much trivial content. Zuckerberg has also announced that Dana White will be joining Meta's board. White is CEO of the Ultimate Fighting Championship and a supporter of President-elect Donald Trump. I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
The world's biggest consumer technology show is getting underway in Las Vegas. CES is about companies trying to get attention for their latest gadgets, gizmos, and other contraptions. A lot of it now with artificial intelligence poured on top. My former Marketplace colleague and now the BBC's North America technology correspondent, Lily Jamali, is there.
Well, from the latest apps to all manner of slick new devices, there is a little something for everyone here at CES in Las Vegas. The event officially kicks off on Tuesday. There will be 4,500 exhibitors showing off their wares across 2.5 million square feet of convention space. Already, we have gotten to play with robot dogs. We've gotten to test out stringless smart guitars, and there's so much more in store from here in Las Vegas. But looming large over the event, politics. There are so many questions about what the incoming Trump administration's tariff policy might look like and whether it could hurt the ability for American consumers to buy the kinds of things that they see on display here at CES. The Consumer Technology Association, which runs CES, has expressed their concern, saying that just for the tablet and laptop market alone, you could see an up to 68% decline if those tariffs end up being fairly stringent. They are hoping that this administration takes a lighter touch approach than some of what has been promised.
The company that's been driving the stock market higher over the last 2 years is chipmaker NVIDIA, the leader in microprocessors to power artificial intelligence. But NVIDIA got there by making powerful chips for computer graphics, especially for gaming. At CES, the new NVIDIA RTX 5090. I could tell you about the 92 billion transistors, but bottom line, games at super realistic 4K resolution, no problem with this baby. The U.S. government's new survey of help wanted ads shows more openings than expected in November, a sign the economy remains strong. Downside is interest rates could now stay higher for longer, and the Dow is down 21 points. The S&P is down 0.6%. The NASDAQ is down sharply 1.2%. The Consumer Financial Protection Bureau is suing a unit of Warren Buffett's Berkshire Hathaway for allegedly entrapping buyers of mobile homes with mortgages the company knew people could not afford to pay. Vanderbilt Mortgage and Finance, based in Tennessee, is the Berkshire unit. Vanderbilt, in a statement, calls the CFPB suit untrue and politically motivated.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Progressive Insurance. Progressive is looking for individuals who want to join an inclusive and unique culture. More information, including application, at progressive.com/careers. And by Clear Channel Outdoor, an out-of-home advertising company with a nationwide network of billboards, offering data-driven solutions that help businesses big and small reach their consumers with accuracy, impact, and scale. Billboardsforbusiness.com.
Now to context on President Biden's order banning oil and gas drilling in 600 million acres of coastal ocean in the name of curbing climate change and lowering the risk of oil spill disasters. Incoming President Trump says he will work to undo Biden-era environmental efforts, but the drilling ban would be extra hard to reverse. Marketplace's Kaylee Wells explains why.
It's tricky because Biden can make this declaration thanks to a 70-year-old law called the Outer Continental Shelf Lands Act.
It grants the president the power to withdraw certain areas from offshore oil and gas development.
Akshay Jha teaches economics and public policy at Carnegie Mellon University. And he says, unlike a regular old executive order,
there isn't a clear mechanism for how a subsequent president can kind of reverse that decision.
President Obama banned drilling 10 years ago using the same law. And when Trump tried to repeal it, the court ruled it couldn't get revoked without congressional approval. So the declaration will stand, at least for a while. And yet,
it does not appear to have a short or even medium-term material impact on drilling.
Morgan Bazilian directs the Payne Institute for Public Policy at the Colorado School of Mines.
Most of the offshore drilling in the United States comes from the Gulf and the parts of the Gulf where that drilling is not covered by this latest ban.
So Biden chose to protect a bunch of land where we aren't doing much oil drilling anyway. Hugh Daigle, who teaches in the Petroleum and Geosystems Engineering Department at UT Austin, calls it largely a political move.
Biden can say, look, you know, I've done this great thing for the environment, while at the same time not really changing the fact that, you know, the Gulf of Mexico produces a substantial amount of our domestic oil and gas production.
But Trump has called the move ridiculous and has promised to repeal Biden's decision. Daigle says that's a political move, too.
It's really just the other side of the same coin.
Meanwhile, Daigle says oil prices have been pretty low recently, so even if there were no ban, expanding production and potentially driving prices even lower is a tough sell right now anyway. I'm Kaylee Wells for Marketplace.
And McDonald's is the latest company to roll back anti-discrimination policies, citing a Supreme Court decision against affirmative action. McDonald's is now ending specific goals for achieving diversity in senior leadership and will no longer encourage suppliers to develop diversity training programs. McDonald's says it's still committed to inclusion and feels diversity is a competitive advantage. Mark, I'm David Brancaccio with the Marketplace Morning Report. From APM, American Public Media.